All right. Hi, everybody. This is RCFB Talk 49. My name is Babak Hariri. Thanks for joining us. We're going to be doing an interview, a special guest, Daniel Libet, who is a reporter with Sportico, who recently wrote a very interesting article on Kevin Warren's Big Ten revival and how fraught it was. So we're going to have him as a guest. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and let him up right now, as well as my co-hosts. As always, I am joined by SRS, Sirius, and JD. So let's see, we're going to get everyone up here right now. Daniel, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
We sure can. It was a little shaky there, but we can hear you pretty clear overall. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be on. Happy to chat.
So, real quick, you've been a reporter now at Sportico for a number of years. How long did it take to put together this excellent long form piece on Kevin Warren's tenure as commissioner?
Well, I started, it was off and on, but I started looking into this and began my reporting about 10, 11 months ago, which was obviously a much different period of time for the Big Ten. This was long before USC and UCLA were going to shock everybody by jumping to the Big Ten from the Pac-12. And it was at a point where it still felt like Kevin Warren, the commissioner, was under siege. He had made his way through all of the controversies of the conference's decisions to stop play, to suspend play heading into the fall of 2020. So he had gotten through that still last year, but he was not a beloved figure still in the conference. And I was told by my initial source that for all of the public controversies that he had endured, there was a complete cluster going on in his own ranks, in his office, as he was trying to professionalize, as he sought the Big Ten Conference.
Daniel, we got most of that, but I do want to say your connection's a little bit shaky on our side.
Right,
I
I
guess.
will try to find a new location. Tell me if this is any better.
No problem, sure will. But no, it's fascinating the amount of work that went into this. I guess my initial question then would be, when Kevin Warren arrived at the Big Ten, what was his approach to setting out and establishing his own, I don't want to say legacy because that's a bit grandiose, but his own sort of approach to running the organization?
And please stop me if I if my audio cuts out again. I'll continue to try to move. His approach was to sort of look at this as a top-down organization and try to find deficiencies to really bring this conference, this not-for-profit that had about 60 employees but was passing through the schools hundreds of millions of dollars each year. He wanted this to look like a hundred. A multi-hundred million dollar organization. And he was also concerned about various things that could trip up the Big Ten. Jim Delaney had done a lot. Obviously, he, was the genius behind the Big Ten Network, which made the con kind of set the conference's course on its of its elite status for years to come. But there were aspects of the organization that at least Warren thought had been left untended. And this was internal stuff and external stuff. And Warren was much more keen to get into the weeds. He wanted to hire, for example, an in-house general counsel, a position that existed at other of the Power Five conferences, but did not exist with the Big Ten. He worried about HR and workplace issues. These are the sorts of things that don't really get a lot of attention at the level of an athletic conference.
Right. And by the way, if you can keep finding a place, it's still the same level of kind of sporadic connection. But you touched on a number of subjects we definitely want to get back to in a little bit more specificity. But because Warren came to the Big Ten after a successful tenure as chief operating officer of the Minnesota Vikings, and I know that in and of itself, the fact that he came from a pro organization with very little college administrative, actually no college administrative experience was a whole separate issue. But you note he has yet to fill the COO position within the Big Ten. So is Warren essentially acting as his own, to use a sports analogy, is he acting as his own coordinator, so to speak?
Well, he certainly acted as the COO and CEO of the organization. And this was a criticism of him, especially during the time when the cancellation of the football season occurred, or the postponement, rather, of the football season occurred, was that his mind was not focused, you know, on the prize at that point, something that he vigorously disputes, but that he, you know, was not delegating, as Jim Delaney had done, to other people to sort of handle the day-to-day of the conference. And that his, you know, he wasn't focusing on the athletic directors. He wasn't, you know, being read up to speed on the way that college sports operates, in scare quotes there. At a certain point, it looked like he was distracted by minutia when the world was falling on top of his head. Now, you know, play resumed 2 months later. Which again makes some people question his judgment of why it was suspended at all in the fall of 2020, but it resumed in October. Ohio State went to the national championship. You know, the most cataclysmic concerns about what's, you know, the money that schools were going to potentially lose never came to pass. And he survived it. And he survived it knowing that if he could last a couple more years, he was going to be in the seat to sign what was likely going to be the largest college sports media rights deal in the history of college athletics. And that's sort of where he has been over the last year. And that's what the Big Ten stands to do really any moment now when they finally lock up that agreement.
Daniel, I think you just went and cut out again. Are you still with us?
Oh, well, it looks like we may have a slight technical difficulty with Daniel right now. We'll get him back on. And it was very interesting what he had pointed out. I just wanted to comment, especially with the background that many of us have here. I'm an attorney. It comes up on a regular basis. Been doing it for about 20 years now. The fact that Warren needed to add a general counsel to the Big Ten was absolutely, I mean, to anyone in I think business or any kind of larger big law or sophisticated entity, that was just an incredible thing that they needed to do that was lacking in that time. But Daniel, are you still there?
Can you guys hear me now?
Yeah, we can. Just to kind of sort of lay the land of the state of the Big Ten when Commissioner Warren took over, How would you define this sort of the legacy of Jim Delaney, and how much did the conference's internal structure evolve in those 30 years that he was at the helm?
Well, Delaney is sort of widely praised. You cannot write a Big Ten story without hearing people say all kinds of highly flattering things about Jim Delaney. You know, he was, I write that he was, in the piece that he's described, I don't think this is an exaggeration, as a kind of Steve Jobs-like genius, especially because of his work in creating the Big Ten Network and keeping all of his members cohered so that it was such a valuable proposition to Fox, which partnered in the formation of the Big Ten Network. So he got a lot of credit from that. And that credit and his ability to sort of both bring along the presidents of the Big Ten and the athletic directors was viewed to be, you know, his greatest strength, his greatest political strength, in just keeping the conference together as it weathered, you know, various different ups and downs. There was the scandal at Penn State, obviously, the scandal at Michigan State. There were, you know, new challenges, new conferences that came to have new media rights deals. But Jim Delaney really, you know, held everybody together. So Kevin Warren was the beneficiary of that. Kevin Warren was also the beneficiary of the fact that in 2016, 2017, when the Big Ten signed its last deal, it was a uniquely short-term arrangement that was only going to last 6 years. This was not the way things traditionally are done. Usually you want to sign at least a decade long, if not longer, media rights deal. But Delaney and the Big Ten presidents agreed to just do this short-term deal with the bet that the market was going to be on the upswing, they were going to be able to come in after the SEC signed their new deal at the high end of the market, reestablish the high mark, which is sort of the position that they are in now. So Delaney loyalists look at Kevin Warren right now as somebody who has just benefited from all of the teeing up that Delaney had done prior to Warren's time. And then, you know, Warren loyalists and Warren himself sees him much more as kind of the central figure in this, that, you know, whatever good or bad comes from the media rights deal really falls on Kevin Warren's shoulders. Kevin Warren is, you know, he didn't hire a media rights consultant for this. He's very, he makes it very clear that he is in the driver's seat, that he's been working on this deal from the very beginning, even in the depths of COVID, that, you know, his eye was on this. So there's a legacy battle in some respects is, you know, this $1 billion plus media rights deal that's about to be signed, Jim Delaney's doing, or is it Kevin Warren's doing? And, you know, the history of that will be interesting in the way it's written.
When Kevin Warren got hired to the Big Ten, especially to fill the massive shoes of Jim Delaney, do we believe at this point that the Big Ten presidents have gotten what they wanted in that original bill of goods? Are they getting what they hoped that they would get when they attracted Warren to the Big Ten?
Well, part of what we need to keep in mind is that there's been such turnover both at the presidential level and the athletic director level. So, you know, the people who are in power at the schools now look very different than they were even 3 years ago. But yeah, I mean, what's very clear is the hiring committee wanted an outsider, or at least somebody who was, a mold breaker on various different scores, and saw that much more with Kevin Warren than the person that was presumed to be the shoe-in for the job, which was Jim Phillips, now the ACC commissioner and then the longtime athletic director at Northwestern. You know, everyone, the athletic directors in the conference, senior staff at the Big Ten, was shocked that Jim Phillips didn't get the job when it was announced. And many people, as I write my story, didn't even know who Kevin Warren was, even though he had a good reputation in the NFL from his time working in the front offices of the Rams and the Lions and most recently the Vikings. He was not somebody who was known in college sports circles at all. And that seemed to be by design. I mean, that, you know, he was the first of what then became a trend of college commissioners who didn't come with college sports experience. And, you know, this was a knock on him. Now, you know, incidentally, we're only a few years later, and he's among the more experienced of the college Power Five commissioners. So, you know, times have changed. His hiring clearly set a trend to look outside of college sports, that having long institutional knowledge in college athletics may no longer be the ticket for a college commissioner.
Obviously, we saw the Big 12 and the Pac-12 go with a non-college athletics background hire prior to the most recent coup with Warren stealing away USC and UCLA from the Pac-12. Do you think that that's going to help reinforce this idea of going out and finding commissioners who don't have that college sports background but have the business knowledge, the legal knowledge, and just general sports background?
Yeah, and I'll just make a point. I don't think anybody is under the impression that Kevin Warren is the reason why USC and UCLA are coming to the Big Ten. And he would be adamant, because of fear of potential torturous interference lawsuits, that the Big Ten did nothing. They just sat there, and this was entirely the schools that approached the Big Ten. So I don't think that alone, the USC-UCLA thing, has, at least in the minds of the decision makers, you know, made them rethink the kind of conference commissioner that should be hired. I think that was already underway. And, you know, to your point, you know, the Pac-12 and the Big 12 already did that. That seemed to be where things were trending, even at the level of athletic departments. There seems to be, you know, it's much buzzier. It seems to be a kind of sexier hire to hire somebody who comes from the business world, who comes from the world of pro sports. as opposed to just, you know, the more conventional person who's come up through the ranks of college athletics. So I think that was already underway. The trend, I think, will continue. I think there's a recognition that college sports has evolved and is revolutionized in a way where having long experience in college athletics may no longer be the guide to give you the right intuitions and moves to make looking ahead to the future.
When you talk about how, you know, you don't need to necessarily have the long history in college athletics to be an effective commissioner, I'm really curious to know how Warren's restructuring of the organization has really impacted the Big Ten going forward. Like, I'm thinking of John Schwartz taking over for the VP of communications role, some of the consolidation of the work that's being done in-house, reversing some of the previous MOs of outsourcing core competencies. How is that restructure of the organization really affected the Big Ten under Kevin Warren?
Well, John Schwartz is part of a trend of hires who themselves are not college sports veterans. I mean, he, as you noted, came from the NFL. One of the key people now in the organization is a guy named Adam Newman, who serves as both chief of staff and deputy counsel for the Big Ten. Adam Newman was a 30-year-old former Vikings intern and recent law school grad when he was hired 3 years ago by Warren. I think he was his first or second hire to the organization and now has a place of great prominence within it. These are non-traditional hires. Kevin Warren is hiring people much in the mold of him, people who he either knows or has familiarity with from his time in the NFL, or people who are coming from outside the traditional talent pool of college athletics. So that's one thing. He is bringing different people. There's also this open question. This applies not just to the Big Ten, it applies to the SEC, to the Big 12, to the ACC, to the Pac-12. What does it mean to be a conference commissioner? And what does it even mean to be a conference now, especially in light of the decline of the NCAA? Is this supposed to be something more than what it was before, which was a sort of pass-through? You know, they were the ones that organized the schools for competitive purposes and also for revenue generating purposes. You know, the Big Ten on its tax return most recently showed it had brought in revenues of $700 or $800 million, but it's not a $700 or $800 million business. It doesn't reflect that in any other way. The money is more or less passed through to the institutions, and that is how the institutions have long liked it. They did not want an autonomous, you know, evolving conference. They wanted the conference to just serve as the sort of steward for the institutions. Warren is sort of questioning that and in some ways redefining what it means to be a college conference. He sees the conference as a bit of an autonomous entity that needs to sort of operate and stand on its own as a kind of business. And, you know, this is interesting. This is an interesting question that both he and Greg Sankey at the SEC in particular are going to have to figure out. Now they are at the top of the totem pole in the power structure of college athletics, much more than the future NCAA president is likely to be. So what is the role now? What are they supposed to do, given that the attention is being placed on them and that the power really is in their hands?
I did note your article did a good job talking, I think, about that and sort of juxtaposing how under Delaney it was very much a pass-through approach to as little should be kind of taken for the conference and then move to the teams. However, I think you also point out, and again, as I've said, it was shocking to me that they somehow never bothered to have an in-house counsel at an entity that large. It might have been a little bit too thin in that regard. But I wanted to shift gears a little bit, and you were touching on the NCAA, and your writing's always been very fascinating on this. In 2011, you wrote that art piece in the Columbia Journalism Review arguing that NCAA rules were creating an unjust system for players. That was back in the wake of Tattoo Gate at Ohio State. So much has changed in the ensuing decade. I wanted to get your thoughts on that. How seismic of a shift has it been, and where do you think we are on that issue?
Yeah, well, I appreciate you going deep into my oeuvre of college sports writing. it has long seemed, especially when Ed O'Bannon filed his lawsuit against the NCAA, that there was a bit of a house of cards that we were looking at, that, you know, this was due at some point, something was going to knock this thing over, because it seemed to be so intellectually and legally unsustainable as it was continuing to grow and grow and grow. And so, my background is, I've still spent most of my career writing about politics. I started covering college sports in 2016, 2017. And my interest in doing so was, I thought, this thing is not going to be what it has been. This thing is ripe for a revolution or possibly a destruction. And I think we've now seen over the last, couple of years in particular, the rug being pulled out from underneath something that people had gotten quite familiar with, even as it was evolving into this mega business. We're not even seeing or hearing the same rhetoric. And it was interesting to listen to Kevin Warren talk at his press conference so explicitly about the money that the conference is trying to generate, because that is now a recognition of what college sports is. It is a giant business. And that's, this is what's finally gotten college athlete compensation rights to the fore. This is what is motivating judicial decisions on these NCAA antitrust lawsuits, is a recognition that what college sports has long said it is, it is not. And college sports is not even saying those things anymore. It seemed inevitable to me that this was going to come for a reckoning. We are watching the reckoning right now. And in some ways, we're trying to still see people keep things more or less patched together while all of these external forces are being brought upon the enterprise. And in other cases, we're trying to see people, or we are seeing people, try to innovate along those lines. And I think, you see somebody like Kevin Warren sort of trying to do both at the same time.
Daniel, I know one of the things that Kevin Warren had said at his State of the Conference was that college sports is in its current predicament because the business of college athletics has grown faster than the structure and governance of college athletics. Is that accurate from your own observations?
No, I thought that was actually a nonsensical thing to say. College sports, the thing that's grown most about college sports is the bureaucracy of it. I mean, which is another way of saying governance, or maybe less of a euphemism. I mean, there has been endless bureaucracy. The NCAA is a testament to bureaucracy without purpose. And so I don't think the governance, that seems to be a convenient way of trying to keep the system together in some form that it is, by perceiving that what we really need, we college sports really need, is more kind of legislation, more authority over the kind of the thing that we're doing right now, as opposed to really from the stirrups, pulling it up and reevaluating the entire enterprise, including its relationship to higher education. So I think that was a misguided assessment of what's going on in college athletics. Yes, the business has grown, but the governance has also grown in conjunction and in mutual support of the business. It's just that the thing doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense legally. It doesn't make sense, from an antitrust perspective, from the prohibitions of athlete compensation. And then at some point, what's going to have to be reckoned is, does this make any sense educationally? And as with the emergence of two power conferences that more or less are going to replicate the NFL, where we're going to probably see things much more quickly in terms of athlete compensation, if not athlete employment status, then what does this have to do with these universities? Why don't we just have more professional football, which is basically what this thing is already?
I think that you're on a good point there about how the NCAA kind of just created this tangled minutia of complicated rules and regulations that didn't really, help promote the sport. It was just more and more compliance for schools and athletes to try to follow. The whole time they're kicking the can down the road on things that seemed inevitable from a fan perspective. And just thinking that, well, it's not going to be an issue. And of course, now these legal cases are coming through that are forcing their hand. Do you think that it makes sense for some of these leaders in college sports to take the approach of, well, you know, Congress, it'll make legislation is going to cover this, and, you know, we're not going to touch it. We're just going to let it, we'll let it be the Wild West until somebody, you know, from an actual government perspective steps in.
Well, I think the idea that Congress is going to pass legislation on this ever in our lifetimes is not a good bet. I mean, we've already seen it. There was all the momentum for college or for Congress to pass NIL legislation. You know, there's all these appeals to Congress. Oh, my goodness, NIL is going to go into effect last July. We don't have really any unifying structure for it. We have this patchwork of state laws. We need a federal solution. And it couldn't even get out of committee. There wasn't even a committee vote. So the NCAA has long said, we need a congressional solution. That is an act of, you know, passing responsibility off to some other entity. Congress is bollocked in all different kinds of ways. It is, to me, a fantasy that in the next 5-10 years there's going to be any meaningful federal legislation that will kind of, you know, supersede whatever the NCAA and the conferences do. So you have two options. One, you can try to regulate. You can try to regulate through the NCAA or some NCAA-like governing body. You can try to regulate at the level of the conferences, or you can try to deregulate in some ways and allow things like the market forces to take place, especially when it comes to things like player compensation. We're still seeing this inclination to try to regulate the way out of NIL, it doesn't seem like a very plausible scenario, a very plausible solution to do that at this moment. And in the background, everybody's saying, well, let's just kind of keep everything together because Congress is going to come in and save us. I mean, anybody who's paying the remotest attention to our national politics should be very wary of that being a real solution that happens in real time.
Well, I know we're coming in on the 30-minute mark, so I didn't want to belabor too many questions on this on various topics so that we kind of get a little more breath and respect your time. But one of the things I did want to ask about is you had that exceptional run when you were doing the New Mexico Fish Bowl site that, I mean, you garnered a New York Times profile. I've read it. I remember when that article was creating all kinds of havoc at the University of New Mexico. As a journalist, what do you think, what were the biggest takeaways from that kind of work that you accomplished with that site? And for those of you out there who aren't familiar with it, it's absolutely worth reading the impact Daniel had with the effort he put in there.
Well, thank you very much. There's no, you will have successfully gotten me on the hook for another half hour if we can just talk about New Mexico. So my transition from politics to college sports was I launched in 2017 a blog, and I was going to do this for a couple of months. I just wanted to investigate one college athletic department, particularly one that wasn't known for scandal, one that wasn't known for anything. The theory was you could throw a dart against a map and whatever, you know, nearest college it landed on, if you really scrutinize what was going on, it was going to struggle to explain itself. And it's, you know, I think I've already conveyed my sentiment and perspective of college sports in the course of this conversation. But, I picked one that I was not completely unfamiliar with. Though I don't live there anymore and I didn't attend the school, I am from New Mexico, so I picked the University of New Mexico, which is, again, a completely, you know, from a national perspective, unremarkable, middle of the road, nobody cares about, Division I athletic department. And my theory was, okay, I'm going to just try to look behind, you know, under the hood, behind the curtain, at how they operate, what they say, and what they do. And because of the nature of the school I picked, which is a kind of mid-major, a lot of what I focused on was financial things, athlete treatment, things that were somewhat universal, things that might be specific to smaller schools like New Mexico. And I instead of doing this for a couple of months, I ended up doing this for 2 years. I filed lots of public records lawsuits. There was much scandal that came out of my reporting in conjunction with some local media outlets. In fact, in, let's say, what are we, in July, in 2 or 3 months, the former athletic director at New Mexico, who I covered during the balance of my time writing the blog about UNM, is going to face criminal trial in New Mexico on multiple counts related to misappropriating funds for a booster golf trip. There was all different kinds of discrepancies, but the main theme of it was, and my presupposition is, if that kind of scrutiny was placed on any athletic department, where a reporter wasn't trying to bust players for impermissible benefits, but was really trying to hold accountable an athletic department, what it says about its finances, what it says about its mission, a similar effect would happen. There was nothing special about New Mexico. It was just the fact that, you know, they ran through the gauntlet of my scrutiny, because most of the time, you know, there's plenty of people who cover college athletics, but most of the time we're covering it as an entertainment. We're covering the on-the-field results. So this was trying to sort of provide an experiment, raise awareness, and also for myself, familiarize myself with the mechanics of a college athletics department.
Well, Daniel, it definitely reflects itself in the work you're doing now for Sportico. So I just wanted to thank you so much for joining us. Again, if those of you haven't read it, Daniel Libet wrote an excellent article that's right now in Sportico on sort of the fraught history, recent history of Kevin Warren's tenure as commissioner of the Big Ten and how he sort of turned that around to be really, it's hard to argue with success. I mean, pulling in USC and UCLA and seeing a conference that seems to be ascendant right now after 2 years of some pretty difficult times. So we encourage you to check out that Sportico article. We've linked it a couple of times. As soon as this is done, we'll go ahead and add it as a reply to the most recent tweet. Actually, it's stuck to the top of our Twitter feed right now as a reply to the announcement of this particular Twitter space. And if you missed the beginning of it, it's automatically recorded. So once this is done, it'll be available for 30 days on Twitter as a recording with the exact same link. In fact, we are now putting these as well into a podcast format. So they're going to be we just started it. So they kind of get populated by all the major podcasts. I know we're on Spotify. We'll be on some others soon. So that'll be an opportunity to also catch up with that. We have more people coming. We love to do these Twitter spaces. Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Eastern, we're going to have Phil Steele, famous for the College Preview magazine. We're really looking forward to that one. In fact, we're bringing in a guest host to help us with some of the more interesting nuances of analytics and advanced stats. But thank you all for joining us. This was RCFB Talk 49. Again, we appreciate you joining us. You can hear the recording as soon as it's done. And on behalf of myself, on behalf of AG, JD, on behalf of Sirius, thanks again. This transmission ends.